Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today we're chatting with Alan Chapman and Andrea Larson, who independently set unsupported FKTs on Minnesota's Superior Hiking Trail just a couple of weeks apart. Join us to hear about their experiences with their first FKTs, their hallucination tales, and why you should check out the SHT. Thank you, Alan and Andrea, so much for coming on the show to talk about the Superior Hiking Trail today. I'm really excited to hear more about this route.
Yeah, thanks for so much for having us on. All the inspiring things that you've done over the years, Heather, are part of the reason why I'm here. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I'd like to start out actually finding out what prompted you to attempt this FKT in particular, and also why you, because you both chose unsupported. And I'd like to start with you, Andrea, because this was not only your first FKT, it was also your first through hike. And what impact, if any, Alan's FKT shortly before yours had on your FKT?
So a large reason that I did it was because I knew about the Superior Hiking Trail for a number of years. I've done a few day hikes here and there. And once I found out about FKTs, it seemed to be the most practical one for me to do that had a great amount of challenge as well as beauty associated with it. And I actually met one of the prior FKT holders, and I live a couple hours from the trail, and decided that I'll try a couple scouting trips up there. I found out a couple years ago that I really like training and adventure. So at the very least, going up there and experiencing large sections of the Superior Hiking Trail, whether or not I attempt the FKT, would be really cool to do. And if I go after the FKT, I figured I had about a 50-50 shot of actually finishing the through hike, but I thought regardless, I'll learn a lot about myself. And after doing the Barkley marathons, I learned that it's okay to go after big things, to find your limits, and failure in to finish something doesn't necessarily mean a failure if you learn a lot about yourself along the way. It being my first through hike, I figured I would have a 50-50 shot, and I actually, the entire planning process, I was going to go self-supported, and last minute, literally 3 days before the FKT, I decided to go unsupported because the logistics were getting very challenging. A ride fell through to get to one of the terminuses. I thought I'd be able to place a cache somewhere in Duluth, but you're not allowed to cache anywhere along the Superior Hiking Trail for a variety of reasons and other very good reasons. But I thought there would be a business that I could go through, and it being a holiday weekend, the post office wasn't even an option. And so then I just said, well, maybe I should reevaluate. And having an engineering mindset, I reevaluated and also flipped directions, because everything that was driving me to start on the northern terminus and go southbound now was a moot point. And when I reevaluated and seeing that the record high temperatures that we'd have and over this period of time, it made more sense to go north.
That's quite the last minute flip. And did you reach out to Alan at all to ask him about his FKT when you decided to go unsupported?
I talked to him before I made that decision, and he didn't know that I was going unsupported until I told him afterwards or during. And so I also didn't want to make it public. Unfortunately, being a female alone in the woods is, you know, I didn't want to put myself as a target either. And so I didn't put a whole lot of information about what I was doing out there other than I was just going for an FKT attempt.
Alan, how about you? What prompted you to attempt the FKT on this trail, and why did you choose unsupported?
Yeah, so why indeed? There are a couple reasons, the first of which, a while ago, a friend of mine introduced me to this Japanese ritual of misoji. And this is admittedly a co-opted Western interpretation of what that means, but the ritual is essentially you do something absurdly hard once a year.
I like this already.
with the idea that it'll radically expand your perceived limitations. And so the rules of this are, number one, the risk of failure, like Andrea was saying, has to be at least 50%. And number two, you can't die, because obviously that means you're not going to stand a chance of completing it.
Right. You're also not going to learn anything.
And so, yeah, right. You can't really take that forward to future adventures. So I found that having a mind-body adventure like this really makes me a lot less likely to enter the kind of fight or flight response and kind of day-to-day life. With the idea being that I did this really long, hard thing, so I can clear out my inbox. I can teach this class. I can do any number of things that are, when you zoom out to that big view that's afforded by these sorts of efforts, that it allows you to face those challenges more head on. So emerging from this effort, feeling like, okay, I exerted myself for a week, hauling all of my gear, eating all of my food except for a little of salami by the end, being eaten alive by mosquitoes and biting flies and being stung by hornets. I can do like the things that I do as part of my job, as part of being a father, other areas of my life as well. So I'd say that that's the first big reason. The second big reason was communicating with the Superior Hiking Trail Association. So big shout out to Annie Nelson, who is the communications director and an author as well at the Superior Hiking Trail Association. So I reached out to them and the timing worked out with their fall member drive. So I was able to make this more of a community effort as opposed to it being exclusively about me, which a lot of times these sorts of things can feel a bit selfish. And it still was definitely a selfish thing to do, but it made it feel less so, which was kind of nice. So as a result of that, as a result of spreading the word of what I was out there doing, there was a surprising and delightful amount of community excitement that grew out of this. Spread on social media. At one point, people were meeting me on the trail and meeting me at the trailheads, which was great. But at the same time, I had to say, don't, you know, give me a high five or anything. This is an unsupported thing. I don't want this to count against that. But I didn't want to let the Superior Hiking Trail Association, I didn't want to let this community that had grown out of this effort, I didn't want to let my friends and family down. So that would be, I guess, the second big why do this.
Okay. Yeah, I like that a lot. There's nothing like doing something ridiculously hard to just give you perspective on everything else in your life.
For sure.
Yeah. Practicing a voluntary hardship. I'm a big fan. Andrea, I'd love to have you talk a little bit about the route as it currently exists, specifically the distance, because I know as I was researching this, it seems like that has changed dramatically over the years and how far you went on your FKT and how that compares to past distances and efforts.
Yes. So Alec can correct me if I'm incorrect on any of this history, but the Superior Hiking Trail started a couple of maybe two, 3 decades ago. And it used to terminate just north of Duluth. And then they completed the Duluth section, which is about 60 miles. And so previously it was about 250-ish miles. And currently as it stands, it's 310 miles. It starts just south of Duluth, goes through, I believe, 8 state parks, and ends within sight of Canada at the northern terminus. You can actually see the river, and on the other side of that river is Canada from that overlook. And you have to hike in to each terminus. That's about a mile and a half hike into the southern terminus that is at the Wisconsin border. It also connects to the North Country Trail, and part of it overlaps with the North Country Trail on the southern side. And then on the northern terminus, you have about a mile hike in, and once again, it diverges from the Boundary Trail, which sounds like it's a very rugged trail that hugs the Canadian border. And almost all of it is trail, despite going pretty much right through Duluth, which is amazing. There's times where you're in Duluth. When I was out scouting, I knew that I was only about 3/4 of a mile away from the Superior Zoo, which was on a spur trail. And I got further down the trail and then realized, oh, I was just like pretty much in a huge urban area and had no idea. And during the FKT attempt that one time, something fell and I was hoping it was an apple. And then something fell closer to me and it turned out it was a golf ball. I was right near a golf course.
Oh my gosh.
And you do go on the lake walk right in downtown Duluth. So it was kind of weird carrying 6 days worth of food on my back as everybody a night was just enjoying the lake walk and the sailboats and all the other interesting things. I know Alan went through in the middle of the night and he had to have a little bit of a reroute because one of the canal bridges was out. But yeah, so it was kind of interesting having that dynamic there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I've also hiked a trail that went really close to golf courses. And I remember at the time thinking, I don't want to get knocked out by a golf ball. That would be a terrible, terrible thing to happen on a hike. And so one of the other little quirks or details, and I'm not clear on this actually, but you both mentioned it, and it seemed like it was an important aspect of the history of SHT FKTs, is going out and back to the Silver Creek campsite. So Alan, can you maybe explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so this would have been, let me see, I think it was on the fifth day, the fifth full day that I was out there. What has happened in the last few years, there have been some land ownership issues along that section of the trail. Normally, the trail went from a county road to Silver Creek, at which there is this campsite. And then it used to continue another mile or two to, I think it's called Gun Club Road.
Yeah.
And it no longer does that section from the campground to Gun Club Road. So the previous person who had gone after the FKT, Jeff Round, had posted that he ended up doing an out and back to that campsite. And in the interest of doing the same thing that he did, I ended up doing that same out and back. It didn't feel much like an out and back because I actually camped there. So I did the first part of the out and back at night and then the next part the following morning back out to the original road and then doing a road. It was a road walk at that point. It was mostly walking. I did a little bit of running on that section, but out to Gun Club Road before resuming on like the next section of the trail, which would have been the Two Harbors section.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that makes sense. You touched on a couple of things there I'd like to hear a little bit more about from both of you. So what was your run versus hike strategy and how did that actually play out in reality? Like how much did you intend to run versus hike and how much did that actually happen?
Yeah, sure. So it didn't actually change all that much. I thought it was going to start out at a higher run to walk ratio and kind of devolve from there. But what was interesting is that as my pack became lighter and lighter, that run walk ratio, which was never all that impressive, didn't really change all that much. I would say that given the terrain, it's a surprisingly vert heavy trail. You got a lot of ups and downs. It's called the Sawtooth Range for a reason. So you've got a lot of up and down, you've got a lot of rocks, you've got a lot of roots, and they're all just awkwardly spaced. So the amount of time I spent running was maybe like 30% total. It was 30% on day one. It was 30% on the final day, because the final day I had pretty much nothing in my pack. So I was pretty delighted that ratio didn't change all that much.
And how about for you, Andrea?
Basically, my strategy was to run whenever it seemed to be more efficient than walking or vice versa. And so my pack immediately started chafing me. Since I switched from self-supported to unsupported very last minute, I had never put this much in my pack before and I physically couldn't fit everything in the pack. So it wasn't till about the final day or two I actually physically got everything in my pack during the event. And so within the second hour of the attempt, I was already chafing because my pack sat so much lower than it usually does. And so I was running and realized this is going to be fun for the next 5-6 days, especially since I have a limited amount of, you know, lubricant, and that's basically needed for my feet for the duration. So that changed my first night, how much I was planning on running, because whenever it was kind of a wash, I would walk. But I was surprised at my race mentality during the whole attempt. I thought I seemed to often be in a race mentality, which was cool to have that mentality for 6.5 days out there. So there was times the first day or two when I was chafing pretty badly that I would have liked to have run because I think it would have been slightly faster, especially during the nighttime when I was hitting some of the flatter stretches that I just decided to hike. But otherwise, I'd say I held pretty true. As Alan alluded to, there was a fair amount of technicality on the trail. So unfortunately, there was a lot of downhills that I was very tentative on. I think this is the mom in me approach now of don't get hurt. And so whenever I'm going downhills, I'm a lot less, I'm just more cautious than I used to be. And I'd have to say that a year ago, I had never used trekking poles. The Barkley forced me to start using trekking poles. And I could not have done this FKT without trekking poles. I think I had them out for all of maybe 4 or 5 miles. And that was basically when I was trying to eat while going on the trail and keep moving while I was eating something more substantial. So they were something that I'm glad I started using because I wouldn't have made it through the attempt without them.
In addition to your running and hiking strategy, I'm also curious about the opposite of that. So can you tell me about your sleep strategy and how that played out on the trail, Andrea? Reading your report, I was just like, take a nap, take a nap, take a nap. It seemed like you went an insane amount of time without sleeping initially.
So I had never done anything longer than 39 hours, and that was a backyard ultra where you have everything at your disposal every 4.1 miles. So this doubled that duration or distance, and obviously length of time much more than doubled that. And so I've never slept in a race type situation before, but I have done adventure races, and adventure racing community is very knowledgeable when it comes to sleep strategy. And so my mentor with adventure racing, as well as some other people, have a lot of experience with sleeping during races. So I tapped into their experience from that. And generally, you go in adventure racing, a lot of the people I talked to go the first night without sleeping. And that was my plan, which I did do. And then my plan was to sleep the second night, which was at that Silver Creek campsite that Alan had mentioned. And so I got there, and it was funny setting up camp, which consisted of a garbage bag, a bivy, and not too much else, putting all my clothes on me, which was basically a lightweight waterproof jacket and a beanie. And I think I brought, can't remember if I brought gloves or not, but I looked at it and I was like, oh, there sure isn't much here. Anyhow, I slept, and then I woke up about an hour and a half later cold because my waterproof jacket was probably not the best thing to wear when I was trying to sleep because I did get a little clammy. I laid there, and that's the biggest thing I would change is when I wasn't sleeping, I would usually try to lay there, and I never fell asleep when I didn't fall asleep immediately. So I should have got up and started moving right away. And then I tried to only sleep during dark hours. This was getting to be fall, so the length of day was getting shorter by a couple minutes every day. And I actually was thinking this attempt would probably be preparation for a real attempt in spring where the day length is a lot longer. And fortunately, everything worked out pretty well. So I don't need to do that spring attempt because I finished in my first attempt. But so as far as sleep strategy goes, and that first time I slept, then I slept again right before dawn again, because I was like, oh, I'm a little sleepy. I'll lay down, and there I just did a trail nap, found some pine trees to go between, and did that. Then the second time I attempted to, or the third night, which was my second night trying to sleep, I found a mossy rock and thought that would be good. It was at a slight incline, so my feet would be above my head, and I thought this was perfect, but it was a little bit windy. This was in the Beaver Bay area. And I kept thinking I heard like raccoons that were going to get my pack or something. And I'm worried I'd have to chase them away or something, because if my food's gone, then the FKT attempt is over. So I just never really settled down there. So I laid there for a couple hours, unfortunately, without sleeping. And then I did start having sleep deprivation issues later on, that I was basically falling asleep while I was walking, and then would instantly fall asleep. At one point, I forgot to set an alarm, and that was my longest I slept. But thank goodness I did wake up after about 4 hours. And at that point, it took me about 23 hours to cover the last 37 miles because I had to sleep twice in that bout, as well as I was having overheating issues, and I would have to sit in rivers whenever possible to try to cool my core temperature down. So yeah, it was a great experience with sleep strategy, but my biggest thing I'd change would be don't linger if you're not falling asleep. Just get pack up and move.
Yeah, that's a good call. Alan, how about you? What was your sleep strategy like?
Yeah, so this Similar to Andrea, I didn't have a lot of experience doing longer events. Like Andrea, this is my first through hike or through run kind of experience. So I knew that sleep was going to be an issue and an unknown issue. And so I was chatting with my coach, Joe McConaughey, about how we should approach this issue. And we came up with a strategy where I'd like ease into the effort, be getting like 3 or 4 hours a night consistently, which in hindsight, I think I could do maybe a little bit less on the front end. But it was really nice to be mentally functional for the first few days, even the middle days. I had all of my faculties about me, which was pretty nice. I would say like the main thing that led to me stopping when I did each night was just like my feet. Wow. Just the sheer amount of time on feet and like the brutality of this trail, all the rocks that are constantly poking, and it always seemed like they were poking the same exact spot. By the end of the day, my feet were just pleading to me to get off of me. So I would kind of stop around midnight or shortly after midnight. So that would have been after a good 4 hours worth of darkness. And my feet would instantly be grateful to me. And I would sit down to a lovely rehydrated meal that was supposed to be rehydrated with warm water, but I was doing the cold soak thing. So I would sit down in my sleeping bag and eat this meal. And by the time I got maybe 3/4 of the way through it, I would pretty much conk out and wake up with the spoon somewhere on my body.
And I did not want to fall asleep with food in my mouth because I've gotten sores in the races I've done. So I made sure that I did not fall asleep while eating. And I brushed my teeth up to 5 times a day to prevent the sores. So I don't know how you could do that.
Yeah, man. Brushing teeth, that was a key thing. I made sure to brush my teeth every morning. It's just such a nice ritual to get into the day and to just like scrape off like all the lingering dinner. So I kept to that 3, maybe 4 hours a night sleep strategy for each night until the final push. So for the final push, I found myself sleeping at a snowmobile shelter about a little over 50 miles from the finish. I took maybe like a 20 or 30 minute nap there after the previous day of somewhere in the neighborhood of like 50, 55 miles. And that's that final push between that snowmobile shelter and the southern terminus is where I encountered some pretty good sleep deprivation related stuff. By about midday, I was seeing, I know now that they were like little like logs on the side of the trail, but at the time I was seeing them as these little piglets that were waving. Hi, how you doing, Al? come toward us on the trail. Like we're where you're supposed to be going. So they were talking me through it and coaching me along, which was nice, but inevitably I would realize that those are actually not real. Similarly, I would see like little branchlets growing out of trees in real time. And I knew enough to know that like that doesn't happen. So all of these signals were telling me that I needed to sleep some more. So I did a few dirt naps and there was one that was just magical. I found this amazing slab that was just a little bit off the trail and it just looked like the most glorious bed. And it was surrounded by blueberries. So I had a mouthful of blueberries and passed out on this slab and set an alarm for 10 minutes. And I woke up looking at my phone. It said 2 seconds left. I hit stop on the alarm and I just felt super rejuvenated and was able to go through the final. At that point, it would have been something like 7 hours or something.
And I know when I was reading your trip report, the piggies were pretty fantastic. But you also mentioned feeling like you were at Berkeley? Were you like looking behind trees for books?
Yeah. So I got it in my head that it was like a treasure hunt kind of thing, a lot like the Berkeley. It was such a strange frame of mind where I knew that I was supposed to be looking. There are these blue blazes on the trail that show you that you're indeed on trail. And so I knew that I was involved in a game that involved hunting for blue blazes. But then once I saw them, I kept forgetting what I was supposed to do next. And the real answer is, oh, just keep going that way. But I kept thinking that I needed to do something like rip a page out of a book or something like that.
And for me, when I was scouting, I had to resist the urge to rip pages out of the books when I found the trail registries, because they're in random spots on the trail. And so I'm like, okay, I got to sign this, not rip out the pages.
Did you have any hallucinations while you were out there, Andrea?
I had two weird things. So I got a phantom text that I didn't realize until days after the attempt that this text never happened. So a current FKT holder, Michael Coppy, was generous enough to pick me up from the Northern Terminus. And I hallucinated that he texted me that he arranged for a shuttle for me because I was taking too long and couldn't continue waiting for me at the Northern Terminus. And the shuttle would be there at 5 p.m. to pick me up. And I was surprised to see him at the Northern Terminus, didn't say anything to him. And then a couple of days later, I was talking to my husband about it. And I'm like, oh, I can check that. Because that's really strange that he ended up staying and didn't let me know that. And I never had a text.
Oh my gosh.
And then the other item was, my last night on the trail, I was on a section that I hadn't previously scouted, but I was connecting to a spot that I had scouted. So I knew I was looking for this parking lot at the state park. And I just felt like I was on this endless treadmill of everything looking the same. And I thought, all right, I knew someone couldn't be with me because I was doing unsupported, but it's like a dream where not everything adds up. So I was arguing with someone with me that kept telling me it was only about 200 meters ahead to the parking lot. And I'm like, no, it's at least 2 miles, maybe 3 miles. I'm not going to pull out my phone to double check the distance, but it's a ways. And it was just terrible between this treadmill of everything looking the same, sleep deprivation, and then someone supposedly telling me it's only 200 meters ahead. And every time there was a little bend in the trail, thinking that was the turn to the parking lot, I just had to go to sleep at that point. And that was the one I accidentally slept too long. And that was the first only time in the attempt where I got up that it was really hard to get moving again. It took me a good mile or two before I could even do more than a hobble at that point. But that was all. I didn't have any trees or anything jump out as weird piglets or anything like that.
That's funny how reality and the surreal kind of merge, because there was another time for me, actually two separate times, where porcupines would just burst onto the trail at night. And they would just start kind of taking off running in front of me, just following the trail. And I thought that they weren't real at first. And I actually have video that proves that they were indeed real. What was great was that they're moving at about the same pace as I was for like 30 seconds to a minute each time I had some company. I had a pacer.
Yeah, porcupine pacer.
Yeah.
The other thing really hit me hard was in Lake Agnes. I think that was my second to last night. And I think this is where sleep started catching up to me, was my headlamp felt so dim. I started out and I was okay when the darkness hit, and then I stopped to sign the registry. And then after that, just everything was just falling apart as far as I would put my headlamp on the same setting as I had the prior nights. And I just felt like I couldn't see anything. So I had to run it on high, and I knew I had enough battery to do that. But it was just really weird how I had no issues up to that point, and then just everything just felt so dim.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't experienced that. I have had a porcupine pacer, and it let me know how slow I was actually moving because they're not that fast. And I was like, oh, all right.
Not at all.
I'm like, I'm not going very fast either. Maybe I should nap.
Yeah. I was wondering if it's still counted as unsupported, you know?
Right.
But they let it through.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think porcupines are, I think they're excluded from the unsupported.
When I saw a porcupine, it was right before dawn, and I thought initially it was a bear cub.
Oh no.
Screwing up a tree. I didn't put two and two together that a cub wouldn't be that small this late in the year, but until afterwards. But I stopped dead in my tracks because I'm like, well, if that's a cub, that's the worst case scenario with a bear encounter, is where's the mom? So I stopped to make sure there wasn't a mom nearby. And then as I inched closer, I realized, oh, that's just a porcupine. I can keep going now.
They do get pretty sizable. So switching gears a little bit away from the nighttime, I'd like to hear what the mainstays of your diet were. What were you eating out there? How many calories were you carrying? Because both of you started with all of your calories from the beginning. Well, like if you had a strategy for eating, what it was. Andrea?
I bought 7 freeze-dried meals because those work better with cold soaks. And that was my first time ever eating freeze-dried meals.
Sure.
And that seemed to be okay. That was the only food I had left. I had, I think, 2 left. I had 1.4 pounds of food left after the attempt. So it was nice to go into, unlike Alan, to go into the last day and a half knowing I had all the more than enough food. And I was trying to eat it so I didn't have to waste the energy to carry it. I started with about 34,000 calories. Last minute, I ended up stuffing a bunch of random stuff in my pockets, so much so that my pants kept falling down at the beginning of that KT attempt. And then as like my pack was chafing in that same area, I realized this might have been dumb. That's all my only pair of bottoms I brought along, that this could be bad because I'll probably lose weight and I'll get even looser as the time goes on. But yeah, not having a pound of food in your pockets helps keep your pants up. Anyhow, so I had the dehydrated food. One thing that I was very proud of, I calculated all the food densities of all my foods I was thinking about. So then I rethought some of the foods that were lower calorie dense foods and did not include them. But I ended up thinking, well, fats have twice as many calories per gram as proteins or carbohydrates. So I brought an entire 16-ounce container of olive oil. And I never drank it straight up. I would just put a couple of glugs in each of my meals, as well as I did bring ramen noodles. And that was the first time I ate ramen noodles, and I don't remember when. My husband was questioning me when I brought home a big pack of ramen noodles. And then I put on races. So there was a bunch of food from aid stations, potato chips and Oreos left over from the last race I put on. And it happened to be about 2,500 calories each. So I was like, oh, perfect. I'll divide those up into 5 baggies and use those because I won't care if they're stale or anything, as well as some other items I had. But yeah, I was really proud about the olive oil discovery because I think that saved me roughly a pound in my pack. And then another thing that my husband's been big on pushing me lately is more protein. I am a carnivore, but I also tend to like my white noodles and white breads. So he's been pushing me to eat more proteins versus carbs. And so I've been doing more protein powder. And so I filled up one water bottle initially just full of protein powder plus a Ziploc bag. But talking to Alan, he thought there was some drier stretches for water in the middle of the attempt. And I figured I would go through that quantity of protein powder by the time I hit there. So then I had that extra water bottle once I needed to load up a little bit more with water on the... So, and I think I had zero muscle soreness after the attempt. It probably helped that my final push was a very slow cool down. And I was actually able to compete in a race just 10 days later and actually do quite well in that race. So it was nice to be able to recover quickly. And I attribute that not only to the not final push I had, but also to the protein.
Yeah. Ellen, how about you?
Yeah. So I similarly packed the bag full with 6 days worth of food, calculated it out to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,600 calories, with the idea that I'd be taking in 6,000 to 6,500 calories per day, which sounded like an absurd amount of calories. I couldn't remember ever taking in that many calories per day. And I remember hearing Heather on your recent episode with Nick Fowler that you similarly couldn't imagine eating that many calories.
No.
But day one confirmed that I was only able to really take in 4,500 calories or so. And then day two is when I became like a beast, where 6,000 calories went down really easy. It also became a lot physically and mentally harder. So I think that's about the time when my body was starting to realize what was happening to it. So 6,000 calories is no problem for that day or for following days. In fact, I think I blew through the amount of calories that I was supposed to be eating for days 2, 3, 4. And then on day 5, in the morning of day 5, I did an inventory of how many calories were left. And I saw that there were about 10,000 calories remaining. So I texted Joe real quick and asked him what I should do, and basically told me, like, continue eating as you are. And the end, you're going to get a little bit bonky by the end, but better to keep the energy flowing now than to be bonking the entire time, like slightly bonking the entire time, which ended up being a pretty wise strategy. I didn't actually end up feeling all that bonky by the end because there were just so many thimbleberries and blueberries and raspberries and service berries on the trail that I was just in hog heaven for big portions of the trail, which is kind of funny because compositionally, the things that I was taking out there were like Fritos and Oreos and salami and just a ton of junk food and garbage. And then I was like counteracting that with foods that were like as potent of sources of antioxidants and like omega-3s as possible. So I had it in my head that like I'm undoing all the damage that I'm doing to my body by eating all this garbage like in real time and supplementing the amount of calories that I'm taking in real time. So that was the strategy. Oh, and I should mention also that I did have dehydrated meals. They were by a brand called Good To Go, which were really tasty, actually.
Yeah,
so good.
Yeah.
I got into the habit of my feet communicating to me, like, I've got about an hour left, dude. You got to get your food hydrating because we're about to call it quits. So I would get the food hydrating then. I would hear it sloshing around in my bag. And then I'd get to camp and mow that down before passing out.
Unfortunately, none of my feet, or it seemed like none of my freeze-dried meals, I could get the Ziploc to reseal. So my plan was to hydrate them while I was moving, but that didn't seem to work. So I was eating them kind of half crunchy. And luckily, like the ramen, you can basically hydrate and start eating right away. The other thing that I ate a lot of that was actually healthy is nuts. I had at least 5,000 calories worth of nuts on me. So I didn't feel like 100% of what I was eating was garbage. But yeah, there's plenty of that too.
Yeah, the balance.
Speaking of the garbage, with all the Oreos and Fritos and all these foods that like actually are pretty physically hard, I found that I was cold soaking things in my mouth by the end, just putting a couple Oreos in my mouth, taking a swig of water and just hydrating things because my mouth started to get kind of dinged up.
And I was afraid that was going to happen, but it did not for me. I had read some of Joe's race reports where Oreo and chip smoothies or whatever he'd call them. And so it's interesting for me when I love to eat. And when I get in these long racing modes and stuff, food kind of becomes indifferent to me. And so I kind of joke that that's my weight loss plan is I can eat all I want as long as I keep moving. And then I can't constantly keep up with it.
All right. Quickly, before we wrap up, your highest high and your lowest low. Andrea, you want to go first?
I would say my highest high on the trail was getting to the Split Rock River. So that was the first time I took an extended break. It was the middle of the day. Things were heating up. And I went in the river and completely soaked myself, washed all my clothes, refilled. And I remember getting out of the river and start to ascend and just literally saying, I feel as fresh as a daisy coming out of there. And that was around the point of my furthest run ever. So it was really empowering to come out of there and just feel like this isn't a problem to keep going, even though I'm hitting new territory. My lowest low would be when I was north of Grand Marais. I was really struggling with heat. And as I mentioned earlier, having to soak my body, trying to get my core temperature down. And there was a point that I was worried about passing out. And then if I were to pass out, I don't want anybody to help me. And if I'm okay, if someone helps me, then I'm not going to be unsupported anymore. And not wanting to ask people, like, do I look okay or anything? Because that would be considered support as well. So just me keeping to myself, getting to this area that's a little bit more busy with people, especially with it being Labor Day weekend. And I told myself I cannot leave this area until I get my core temperature down. And you get little families frolicking in the water and me not being able to interact and basically saying, I'm at my lowest low now. So luckily I got out of there. I was shivering a little bit. Obviously it didn't last long, but got through that low point where I was afraid of having heat exhaustion.
That's scary. Ellen, how about you?
So I'll start with the lowest low, which was leaving my phone behind. So similar to Andrea, I enjoyed some body soaking in the middle to the end of the effort. And there was this beautiful river that I came across. And I was just loving life at that point because I got to soak my feet. I got to taste some of the cleanest water that I tasted the entire trip. And one of the weird things that ends up happening on this trail, and it probably happens on other trails as well, but I couldn't tell if I was making this up or what, but from river to river, you notice some differences in taste of the water.
Oh, yeah.
But this specific river, the Caribou River, was just amazing water. And I was just really enjoying that. And I took a bunch of pictures and I ended up leaving my phone there.
Oh, no.
Before continuing on. And then I got a little over a mile further down the trail to this overlook, which they've cleverly called Overlooked Overlook.
I saw your picture and I thought that was hysterical. I'm like, I want to go here now.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of humor on the trail, which kind of keeps your spirits high. There's Overlooked Overlook. There's something, you look at this overpass, this highway, I think it's 35E, Interstate 35, this overpass, and it's called Overpass Underlook later on in the trail. But so I get to Overlooked Overlook and I'm like, I got to take a picture of this sign, and I didn't have my phone. And up to that point, I had been using it to navigate and to take pictures and video and to listen to music and podcasts. And just generally, it was a big item, like probably the MVP of all my gear. And I realized that it was behind, and I didn't know where I had left it. I just knew at that point I had to backtrack, because if I didn't find my phone, it would have been like a mental crush. And it also would have meant that navigation would have been much more difficult from there on out. So I backtracked, and fortunately I was reunited with my phone. So after the lowest low came a big high. So it was kind of a roller coaster of a day, honestly. Another like strange low was after finishing at the Southern Terminus, you have to hike back out a couple miles. And I was just so depleted that it was really difficult. I had forgotten, oh yeah, I need to do that extra couple miles.
Oh, wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more. Exactly. So hopping over to Highest High, reuniting with my phone was a big one. Being paced by those porcupines was a pretty amazing moment. Just a lot of positivity on the trail in terms of the people that were out just enjoying the trail that knew about or didn't know about what I was up to. Being in this beautiful place, I got blasted by this thunderstorm. At one point, it was this brief but like epic thunderstorm that brought down at least like an inch of rain per hour and turned the trail into a river. And I stopped worrying about getting my feet wet, and I just splashed around in it, uh-huh. Which was pretty great. And the trail ended right when I got to this amazing overlook at it's this part of the trail called Section 13. And at that point, there were still all the clouds in the sky from the storm, but then the sun set below like the cloud deck, and it was just this like magical moment. So okay. I was pretty giddy after that point. I guess I'm going through several highs here. There were a lot of things that I was pretty psyched about. Another one, I guess I'll have this be the last one, was seeing my wife at the finish. She had a turkey sandwich for me and a ginger ale. I was like, I love this woman. She's great. She drove me back to her dad's place, who lives actually pretty close to the Southern Terminus. Called him and told him to put a frozen pizza in the oven. And so there's a frozen pizza that had just come out of the oven when I got there. I hopped in the bath with this frozen pizza. I took a couple bites and then fell asleep and woke up to just like pizza floating in the bathtub.
Oh God. Oh no. So your recovery was a little different than Andrea's. She was like out running races and you were sleeping in a bathtub with pizza.
Exactly. Yeah. It took me a while afterward to get hungry for adventures like this again, but I'd say the hunger is what hasn't fully returned yet is sensation in my big toe and the toe adjacent to it on both sides.
Oh yeah. I have a part of my toe that has been numb for 20 years and I don't think it'll ever come back.
Who needs to be able to feel their toes?
I mean, I do just fine feeling two thirds of the toe. So On that note, thank you guys both so much for coming on the show and telling us about your adventures on the Superior Hiking Trail this summer. It was really great hearing all about it.
Absolutely. Can we do a plug for how great the Superior Hiking Trail is?
Sure, go ahead.
You know, the Midwest is often overlooked, and the Superior Hiking Trail, compared to a lot of mountainous through hikes, you don't have to worry about the dangers associated with it. So you're not going to have these epic snowstorms or very unpredictable weather. There is a lot of accessibility. There's road crossings very frequent that you're never far from help. And as a woman, I never felt that I was far from help being by myself. But the beauty of the Superior Hiking Trail is just amazing. I grew up not far from the, you know, a couple hours from the Superior Hiking Trail, and I've lived in the Midwest my whole life, and it really encapsulates what the Midwest is. Not only do you have beautiful woodlands and nature and wildlife that we mentioned, but we don't have to worry about the dangers either of a you know, mountain lion attacking us or a grizzly bear. But we also have so many vistas, whether you're overlooking Lake Superior, the city of Duluth, or just endless trees as far as you can see. But the freshwater on this trail really makes it special. Water's never an issue. This was one of the driest summers we've had up here, and I think I never had to carry more than 64 ounces of water on me. But you get to, you know, soak in all these beautiful fresh waters. Only one time did I drink something that tasted a little bit off. Otherwise, often I was drinking and saying to myself, oh, this is so good. And so many waterfalls on this trail. I mentioned 8 state parks. When I was going with my family to scout, the state parks started blending together because there's so many state parks with rivers that go into Lake Superior. And just so woven, as I mentioned, even when you're doing the urban section, which adds a lot of character as well to the hike, but you don't even realize you're in one of the biggest cities on all of Lake Superior. And it's just woven in there so awesome with all these little parks and stuff that you're going through. So I would highly encourage anybody that thinks that there's nothing to see in the Midwest to come out on the Superior Hiking Trail, and you'll be proved otherwise.
And I would just piggyback on that, saying that with the trail, there's also a fantastic community, the Superior Hiking Trail Association, that is a great nonprofit organization. They do trail construction, they maintain the trail, they manage it, and they promote it. So if you enjoy the trail like we do, or if you're curious about coming out and seeing it for yourself and enjoy it after that, consider becoming part of that community and consider giving to that trail.
Thanks again, Alan and Andrea, for coming on the show. You can read about their FKTs on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow Alan's adventures on Instagram at Alan Daniel Chapman. Andrea's adventures are on her blog at ironbull.org.